and more. In December, Noam Chomsky will be celebrating his 90th birthday. Oh, and happy birthday to Rob Young here at Democracy Now! And Democracy Now! Has a job opening for a broadcast engineer in our New York studio. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Nat Needham, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars. I'm Amy Goodman. Get our transcripts at democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
Music has evolved a great deal in the past 300 years. And that's only because of artists who were able to express themselves in ways that the common practice couldn't. Music is art, and great art should seek to change the world. No one knows when the next wave will break, but when it does, you can rest assured you'll hear it on the Spaces of Place program every Friday evening from 6 until 8 p.m. with me, your host, Tom Wilson, right here on your favorite radio station, 89.3 WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves.
This is the sound of salmonella gyrating on your undercooked chicken. And it looks like mom might be taking it out a little early. Don't let salmonella get funky with your chicken. On average, 1 in 6 Americans will get a foodborne illness this year. So use a thermometer to cook each type of meat to the right temperature. Keep your family safe at foodsafety.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
This is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.
WHFR.FM. This is WHFR Making Waves. I'm Alan Mazurek. It's just about 1 o'clock here on a Friday afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us here on WHFR. Susan McGraw and I have, one more week of summer vacation from the new WHFR Journal. We will be back next Friday at this time, broadcasting live from Dearborn's homecoming over at Ford Field, which, of course, takes place Friday, Saturday, and Sunday with lots of music and entertainment and other stuff going on. And, a great time had by all, as many of you know, at Ford Field here in Dearborn for the Dearborn homecoming. WHFR will be down there all 3 days next weekend, including our live broadcast of the new WHFR Journal, 1 week from right now here on 89.3. Anyway, to wrap up our series, a 6-part series on education in America, please stay tuned up next for this very special program that we're pleased to present you, Degrees of Separation, Part 6, here today on the new WHFR Journal.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is With Good Reason. The most expensive school board race in history might indicate a trend across the country.
The charter school supporters saw this as a political red line, that charters are now a powerful force, and if you cross charters, then you can expect to lose an election.
We asked the experts about the pros and cons of charter schools.
Our school systems are not merely failing some kids. They are obsolete for all kids. They don't need reforming, they need reimagining.
Plus, how does school choice play out for the 10 million American kids who live in rural districts?
I mean, choice only works if you've got choices, right? And, you know, a lot of rural communities, they just don't have the variety of options that are kind of assumed with a lot of these choice policies.
All this and more on With Good Reason. First, the news.
As an 18-year-old, I let my mistakes kind of take over my life. I was 0.5 credits away from completing high school, and I didn't do it.
10 years later, at age 28, Jackie finished her high school diploma.
When I found out that I was pregnant, I know that I had to do something for myself if I wanted to make her a better person and provide a better life for her. My family never stopped pushing for me to be better because they knew what I could become and who I could become as a person. My support team is amazing. The educational director, my sister, and even my 7-year-old daughter has just been more than the support that I could ask for. I've been given an opportunity, and I'm just thankful for it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Dearborn Homecoming is Friday, August 3rd to Sunday, August 5th. And WHFR will be set up all 3 days. In the WHFR tent is the ever-popular Purge CDs and vinyl for a dollar donation each. There will be WHFR merchandise for sale as well. The WHFR tote bags are back, and they are only $30 a piece. Not only do you get the tote bag, but you also get to fill it up with as many Purge CDs and vinyl as you can fit. Additionally, WHFR is excited to have their latest music project, Motor City Gems, available for purchase. This blue vinyl release features local indie rock with artists like The Beggars, The Zots, Rogue Satellites, Seatbelts with Nikki Corvette, The Kenny Hill Group, The Mugs, and many more for the low, low price of $14. Make sure you stop by the WHFR tent at Dearborn Homecoming to pick up these musical gems.
Graduates, would you please be seated?
This is the sound from U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos speaking at a university commencement in Florida.
As I said, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be with you today.
As DeVos takes the podium, students are booing and shouting in protest.
While we will undoubtedly disagree at times, I hope we can do so respectfully. Let's choose to hear one another out. I want to reaffirm
this. Betsy DeVos is at the center of one of the biggest debates in education in decades, school choice. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, the final part in our special series on education and inequality, we're calling Degrees of Separation. In recent years, school choice advocates have poured millions of dollars into lobbying for new charters in districts across the country, often facing staunch opposition from teacher unions. In Los Angeles, this conflict came to a head in the most expensive school board election in history. With Good Reason, associate producer John Last has the story.
The first thing you need to know is that most Angelenos didn't even know an election was happening. But if you were in the Los Angeles Unified School Board's 4th District, this election was hard to avoid.
I mean, if you were a voter, you were getting like 7 or 8 mailers every day.
This is Howard Bloom. As education reporter for the Los Angeles Times, he was a frontline witness to an epic dust-up, a battle waged between two ideological forces with seemingly unlimited money at their disposal, and a preview of what might come to the next school board election in your neighborhood. Until this year, District 4 was represented by this guy.
I'm Steve Zimmer. I am a 25-year veteran teacher and counselor.
Zimmer served 8 years on the Los Angeles School Board. He even became school board president. And he got there thanks in no small part to outspoken support from California's kingmakers, the teachers union. For decades, the California Teachers Union was the biggest spender in state and local politics. Cross the union and your career might be cut short at the next election. But by the time Zimmer ran for re-election the first time in 2013, the balance of power was beginning to shift. It all had to do with charter schools.
A new charter school could be opening in Lost Hills very soon.
There's a brand new charter school opening up in South L.A.
First of its kind school aimed at helping troubled youth at a critical time.
To a charter school.
Another year of just remarkable growth in charter schools in the state of California.
But that expansion has created serious competition for limited public resources.
The L.A. Unified School District has more charters than anywhere else in the country. 150,000 students are enrolled in charters, with 40,000 more on wait lists. When Steve Zimmer was sitting on the school board, he wasn't exactly anti-charter. But in recent years, as charters expanded rapidly, his viewpoint had started to shift. Here's Bloom again.
The charter school supporters saw this as a bad sign for the future, and they also wanted to make a statement, you know, put down this political red line that charters are now a powerful force and they deserve to be a powerful force. And if you cross charters, then you can expect to lose an election.
The Charter School Association found their champion in Nick Melvoin, a West Side lawyer with a private school education.
His family is very well connected on the West Side. His father is a Hollywood producer, and all of his classmates and friends come from families who can afford to make donations, who are high propensity voters, who are many of them very willing to believe bad things about the school district.
When Melvoin announced his bid for Steve Zimmer's seat, pro-charter organizations lined up to support him. If Melvoin won, union-backed candidates would lose their majority on the school board, and they could expect a more liberal attitude to new charters. Both sides unleashed an onslaught of spending. And that's when things turned nasty.
What the campaign was is that the district is terrible, is made no progress, it's awful, it is almost unredeemable, and the person most responsible for this is, by definition, the person who has been the president of the school board, and therefore you should throw the bum out.
Here's how Nick Melvoin puts it.
My value proposition to voters was just that we have a school system that is not working for our families or for our city. Academically, we have only 30% of kids proficient in math. We only have 47% of kids graduating eligible for college.
Those numbers are all correct, but that's not exactly what the mailers were saying. Pro-charter ads put images of Steve Zimmer in a tank, making him look like a militarist for purchasing surplus equipment for the LA school police. They used footage from The Making of a Murderer to somehow suggest Zimmer's criminality. And in one ugly incident, a group even made a fake phone survey suggesting Zimmer was responsible for sexual assaults that occurred in schools while he sat on the board, drawing condemnation from both candidates. These ads came from PACs with names like PTA and Students for Reform, despite having next to no connections with students or their parents. But dirt was flung in both directions. Here's Bloom again.
On the other side, the union campaign was largely based on equating Nick Melvoin with Donald Trump and his education secretary, Betsy DeVos.
Even though Melvoin is a Democrat, and on issues like immigration, he's firmly opposed to Trump's policies. When it came down to it, the vast majority of spending was by outside groups, and pro-charter backers outspent the unions 2-1. At the end of it all, Melvoin won, and by a healthy margin. He says what this election was really about was school choice.
I taught at a school in Watts where only 4% of eighth graders were proficient in math, and the year before I got there, our assistant principal was arrested for raping a student. Any parent who says that if they had a choice to go to another school, wouldn't exercise it, I think is kidding themselves. And so what I say is my family growing up on the West Side with some means was able to say, oh no, we're not sending our kid to a school like that. But most parents in America don't have that opportunity.
For his part, Steve Zimmer saw something a little more sinister.
The idea, I think, from the Charter Schools Association was that if Los Angeles would fall, then there would be kind of a domino effect across the country. This is about an experiment in trying to take over or radically change one of the major foundational public systems in our democracy.
Bloom agrees. This election was about more than just LA.
Los Angeles is still a union stronghold. And if they could win here, they'd be sending an important message. Politicians want to win elections, and they will think twice before they cross the California Charter Schools Association.
That was With Good Reason associate producer John Last. We're going to bring some expert voices into this conversation, beginning with Diane Ravitch. Diane Ravitch is a former Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. But in the years since, she's become one of the nation's most outspoken critics of charters. She says they're the result of 30 years of unjustified assaults on public education, and they may spell the end of our public education system. Diane, just a decade ago, the charter schools that you once thought would be a good thing were still relatively rare. Now they're in 42 states, and more are spoken of as a possible replacement for the public education system. How did charters begin?
The idea of charters back in 1988, when they were first proposed by Albert Shanker, who is the leader of the American Federation of Teachers, the second biggest teachers union, was that charters would be led by teachers, and they would focus on the kids who were the neediest. They would find new ways to energize learning, and they would share it with their colleagues. Shanker, however, after 5 years, in 1993, he announced that he was completely abandoning charters because he decided they were really no different from vouchers. The reason he reached that conclusion was that he saw that big business was moving in and was going to use charters as a way, first of all, of getting rid of unions, and after all, he was the head of a national union. But secondly, he saw them as a way to privatize schools. And he died in 1996, but what he said was absolutely prophetic. And it took a while before I came to agree with him, and I didn't abandon charters until around 2007, 2008, because at that point, it was very clear that an industry was emerging. And this industry is not teacher-led schools. It's charter schools created by people who are not educators and don't have a clue about how to educate anyone. So it's been, for me, an enormous disappointment because I shared the vision that Shanker had, and it's very clear that that vision has died.
So were the corporate interests that helped charter schools proliferate aided by the federal government interests?
Well, what happened was that when the charter movement began to come of age around 2000, that was also the time that Congress passed a bill called No Child Left Behind. And No Child Left Behind said that if a school was failing, meaning that if it had low scores, then the school could be turned over to charters. That encouraged the proliferation of charters, but what really gave them an enormous boost was the federal program started by President Obama and Arne Duncan called Race to the Top. In 2009, right after the economic collapse of 2008, Arne Duncan, who was then Secretary of Education, had $5 billion in discretionary money, and he used it to have a contest for the states. And he said, you're not eligible to get any of this money unless you increase the number of charter schools that you have. Now, at that point in 2009, we already knew that charter schools were not performing better than public schools, and yet he insisted that this $5 billion was unavailable to states that did not have charters. The public has yet to understand that every dollar that goes to a charter school is a dollar taken away from their own local public school.
But you see these articles periodically about charters that are spit and polish, and they've got poor kids in inner cities that are wearing uniforms and behaving beautifully and learning well, teachers that are devoted to their well-being, and it all looks rosy.
Well, those articles are part of the marketing campaign for charters. There are some charters that get incredibly high scores, but they always have the same methods. First of all, they don't admit students with disabilities. If they admit any at all, they're kids with mild speaking or hearing disabilities. They also, most of them, have very, very few children who are learning the English language. They also have rather stern disciplinary policies that allow them, first of all, to suspend kids who misbehave and then to kick them out. Public schools have to take the kids that the charters kick out. So it's really not, it's never a fair comparison, because those spit and polish charter schools, they're gaming the system and they're playing with the stats.
Are they less expensive to operate?
No, they're not less expensive. I mean, I remember back when the charters started, the claim was they'll be less expensive because they don't have a central bureaucracy. But it turns out that's not true at all. Charters actually spend more in administration than regular public schools do. The most successful ones have very, very big fundraising operations. The game is that they find some very wealthy billionaire who underwrites them, and at some point in the future, they will get all their funding from the public.
So in defense of Barack Obama and his education secretary, Arne Duncan, and others who are charter advocates, they would say, we're not trying to replace the public school system. We're just trying to supplement it, provide a space for innovation in education, because clearly some of the schools are failing miserably. What would you say in response to that?
Well, I would say that if you look at the charters nationally, as I have, there's no innovation that's come from a charter. The big idea of the most successful charters is what they call no excuses, which means you get suspended if you talk in the halls, you get suspended if you talk in the lunchroom, you get suspended if you speak out of turn, and then at a certain point with enough suspensions, you get expelled. Well, that to me is boot camp. That's not an innovation.
What if we were publicly funding all charters? What if every public school was a so-called charter?
Well, if you have no public schools left and only charters, they're just going to kick them down to the low-performing charters. And New Orleans is a good example of that. Almost every school in New Orleans is a charter. And the high-performing charters are very difficult to get into. And when they don't want kids, they kick them down to the low-performing charters. There are fundamental issues in American education that need to be addressed. And this whole conversation about school choice, which was started years ago, this is a diversion from addressing the real needs of children and of teachers and of schools. I feel where public education today is in an existential crisis, and we'll be fortunate if we still have a public school system that's functioning 10 years from now.
If you were Secretary of Education right now, what would you do with the public school system?
Well, what I'd do, first of all, would be to eliminate funding for charter schools and vouchers and focus entirely on the neediest schools. The other thing I would do would be, I mentioned that Race to the Top included a gift to Duncan of $5 billion to use as he wanted, and the evaluations conducted by the Department of Education showed $5 billion produced nothing. I mean, there was no return from having bet on charters and high-stakes testing. So I would replace that with, what can we do to integrate our schools, and what can we do to make sure that schools have the kind of services they need so that children are neither hungry nor lacking in adequate medical care? Because if you want to really raise test scores, don't focus on the test, focus on children's well-being.
What would you do with your $5 billion toward innovating in education?
I think the best way to get more and more innovation from the public schools we have is to free teachers from the burden of standardized testing. Standardized testing sends a very strong message saying that innovation doesn't matter. I mean, if you think about innovation, you think, well, you know, children need to learn to be creative. They need to have initiative. They need to figure things out. Standardized testing doesn't encourage any of that. It discourages that. In my view, children should be tested, but the test should be written by their teacher, because the teacher knows what he or she taught.
If people at home want a robust public education system, what do you advise they do?
Well, the first thing they have to do is be informed. Join the Network for Public Education, which will keep you informed. That's an organization that I helped to found, and it was founded specifically to defend public education and to make it better. And our view is not that public education today is great, but that it should be far better, and it's not going to get better by continually draining funds and its best students away. And then join with others in your community and those who oppose privatization. Privatization of the public sector always ends up benefiting someone financially and harming the public. And I think that's a very important principle to be aware of. And follow the money. Follow the money is crucial.
Diane Ravitch is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education and the author of numerous books on school choice. Her most recent is called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. My next guest says, even if some charters are abusing the system, the answer is not cutting back on them. It's making more. Tony Wagner is an expert in residence at Harvard University's Innovation Lab and the author of Most Likely to Succeed, Preparing Our Kids for the Innovation Era. He says today's public schools can't keep up with the demands of the modern economy, and it's time to replace them. Tony, tell me about yourself. You've sometimes referred to yourself as a lapsed high school English teacher.
Recovering is the word, Sarah. I'm a recovering high school English teacher. I taught high school English in both public and independent schools for a dozen years. And then I became a school principal. I started a nonprofit organization. Then I moved into academia and have lately been writing some books about education and the new economy.
Did you have good and bad experiences as a teacher, let's say, in the publics and in the privates?
It was the best of times, Sarah. It was the worst of times in education. In the public schools, you know, I saw that by the age of 15, in many suburban high schools, there were only two categories of kids, winners and losers. And those definitions and categories were created in ways that I thought were very destructive to kids and also to learning. And so I actually, in my public school teaching years, headed up an alternative public high school within a school for the kids who were most at risk.
How did that work out?
It worked out extremely well, because what I came to understand about working with at-risk kids is that the fundamental challenge is to help them sort of think about their future, to begin to have a sense of hope, and then from that intrinsic interest, build out to where they begin to acquire the knowledge and the skills that they need to move on.
Let me ask you, super hard to do with A, a large class size, and B, when you're teaching, you're frantically teaching to certain standards, right?
Well, I couldn't do it in today's working environment, Sarah. When I started teaching, it was 1971. I had a much, much smaller group of kids to work with. I also had the latitude to create my own structure, so I did not have to meet a certain number of classes every day. And that enabled me to have more time to have conferences with individual kids and get to know them. This was also a time where we were not preoccupied with teaching to tests. I didn't have the pressure of having to teach to a test to keep my job. All things now that most public school teachers deal with in ways that are very, very counterproductive.
The reason we especially wanted to speak with you is because you've been an outspoken advocate for charter schools and have worked closely with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is aggressively pushing for the expansion of the charter system. What has your experience in charter schools been like?
Well, let me step back a half a step. It goes back to, what is your theory of change? Now, a dominant theory of change in education today is that education is a monopoly. Schools are a monopoly. We have government schools. And the only way to have better schools is to have choice. Another part of that theory of change is that unions are bad. They're part of the problem. And so let's have choice, but let's make sure that we weaken or eliminate unions altogether. That is a dominant theory of change today in education. And I think it is profoundly flawed. As we know, there are as many charter schools that underperform comparable public schools as overperform them. And then as to the union issue, you can go to right-to-work states, you can go to charter schools that have no unions. Do you see dramatically better teaching? No. So then there's another theory of change, and this is the one to which I subscribe. Our school systems are not merely failing some kids. They are obsolete for all kids. They don't need reforming. They need reimagining. And in order to do that, we have to encourage educational research and development. And the reason I went on to study large numbers of charter schools and seek ways to support them and strengthen them was to create a system for educational R&D, one that still exists today. And all of those schools outperform conventional schools as well as the other kinds of charter schools by any measure you care to use, whether it's test scores, college admission, or college completion.
So if charters are a way to experiment with teaching and getting it right, why don't we take the best of what they are showing us and then replicate that throughout the existing public school system.
Of course, that's the problem. The lessons we are learning from the best of the charters are not being translated back into public education. And that's because charters and public schools have been set up in opposition to one another. They are competing for scarce resources in a world that's a zero-sum game. Many public schools see charters as the enemy. Many charters see public schools as kind of mired in bureaucracy and unable to change. But if we saw these charters as for what they are, which are laboratories of innovation, we'd begin to see a transformation. Let's say that every school district can create their own in-district charters. More than a decade ago, they created what are called the Boston Lab Schools. And they're outstanding public charter union schools that do very, very well.
So we can have unions and charters?
Absolutely. There's no reason not to. Look, let me go on record here. I do not favor tenure. I never have. I never will. But having said that, I do not see unions as the primary problem in education today. Unions, of and by themselves, are not the problem. The problem is a system where we haven't agreed on the outcomes that mattered most. We have not agreed on a theory of change, if you will.
What would you say are some of the biggest challenges that are facing public education? For instance, the problem of scale?
Certainly scale is a problem, but that's not where I'd start. The problem that we really haven't touched on today at all is poverty. We have a 22% childhood poverty rate in this country. The number of homeless kids has actually gone up in the last 5 years, not down, despite an improving economy. We don't want to talk about poverty in this country. We wring our hands at the plight of the poor middle class, but we don't talk about what we're going to do about poverty. And we expect schools and teachers to solve the problems of poverty. And it's simply not possible.
What about detractors of charters who say charters are able to get the results in part because they can pick and choose desirable qualities from the wider population of students?
I think that is an entirely fair and appropriate criticism. But having said that, there are models out there in the charter world that try to mitigate against that. So I do think that when we think about what should the charter of a charter school be, addressing these issues of equity of opportunity need to be very much a part of the equation.
How do you propose that school boards keep public charters public when they're often run by private, unelected boards and educational management organizations who have little public accountability?
To me, the solution is one that Paul Hill at University of Washington has advocated for many years. Yeah. School districts should become chartering agencies, determining who should get a charter, under what conditions, in what circumstances should it be revoked, and so on, so that every school district has schools of choice.
Give me an example of a place where the public school district as a chartering agency has done a really terrific job in making sure there are multiple choices for every family.
Well, the city of Cambridge, where I live part of the year, has made a serious effort to do that. But I don't think the idea has really been tried at scale. The problem is that the market incentives aren't allowed to operate. So if nobody chooses a high school, it doesn't get closed down. So that's problem one. The other problem is parents don't know what they don't know. They don't necessarily have criteria for how to find a good school. We think the best question to ask is, what's your test score average? You know, how many kids go to college? Well, that's entirely a function of money. That is entirely a function of the social economic status of that community. Better to ask, what percentage of kids go on to some form of post-secondary and complete post-secondary? So, unfortunately, parents don't often know to ask those kinds of questions.
Tony Wagner is an expert in residence at Harvard University's Innovation Lab and the author of Most Likely to Succeed, Preparing Our Kids for the Innovation Era. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back.
You don't usually get a stock tip from a 16-year-old, but I'm here to tell you about a different kind of stock. It's called Better Futures, a stock for social change that's not about making money. Instead, you invest to help students like me go to college, which ends up making the future better for all of us. My name is Alicia, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford College. Henry Ford College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Welcome back to With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. School busing for integration feels like a thing of the past, and in some ways it is. In 2007, the Supreme Court ruled that districts could no longer use race as the basis for school assignment. It forced districts committed to integration to get creative. With Good Reason, associate producer Allison Quantz reports.
When Sarah Garland was in elementary school, every weekday she rode the school bus from the suburbs into the city.
I can relive it today. You know, it's like over and over.
It was 20 minutes long.
And we would get on the highway
past the bacon processing plant.
And then you would get downtown and there was a brewery. And so you had this sort of like old potato smell in the air.
It's almost a cliche.
The changing scenery, you know, from like the leafy suburbs to going downtown.
Downtown Louisville, Kentucky, that is.
To this area that was really very low income, very impoverished part of the city.
Today, Sarah Garland is the executive editor of the Hechinger Report, which writes about education and inequality.
You know, my job, I trace that directly back to my experiences on the bus in elementary school.
Louisville first started their busing program in the 1970s as a result of a court order, and it's survived a lot since then. First, there was resistance primarily from white residents. This is from an anti-busing riot in 1975. Then, in the 90s, some black leaders raised concerns. They argued it placed an unequal burden on black children, who had to be bused longer and farther away to create integration. Plus, it was breaking up their schools and communities. Here's Sarah Garland again.
There was, you know, a sense that you guys are telling us that we have to sit next to white kids to do well, and that's not right.
Throughout these years, the busing plan evolved, balancing racial integration with choice. In 2000, when the courts ruled that Louisville could officially stop busing if they wanted to, the district chose to keep the program voluntarily. But they hit another speed bump in 2007. The Supreme Court ruled that busing based on an individual student's race is unconstitutional.
You know, I still remember seeing
the nightly news that night.
This is Erica Frankenberg, a professor at Penn State University.
They were reporting on this major case, and there had been a press conference with members of the Louisville School District.
They had an incoming superintendent.
Welcome to the job. And they vowed to continue to figure out how to pursue integration within the new legal constraints.
2 years later, Jefferson County Public Schools rolled out a new plan, not looking at the race of individual students,
but thinking about the racial and economic composition of the areas that students lived in.
After more than 30 years of challenges, this is the busing program Louisville uses now. It's pretty complicated, so I'm going to bring in Dina Dossett to help me explain.
My name is Dina Dossett. My job is the Chief of Data Management for Jefferson County Public Schools.
The new integration plan starts by taking every neighborhood in the Jefferson County Public Schools and categorizing them into one of three groups.
We creatively call them Category 1, 2, and 3.
The categories are based on census data about race, income, and education levels.
So Category 1 areas of Jefferson County tend to be higher minority, lower income, and lower educational attainment.
Category 3 areas tend to be lower minority rates, higher income, and higher educational attainment.
And Category 2 is kind of a combination.
Every school is made up of a mix of students from each category. To get that mix roughly even, they divided the district into 13 clusters, made up of about the same percentage of neighborhoods from each category. Still with me? Each of the 13 clusters is almost like a mini school district, and within that district, you have some choice. You rank elementary schools within your cluster.
From your first choice to your last choice.
And then you go into a computer system. It looks at whether your kids have siblings at the school.
Whether there's room in that school for accepting students.
They look at what they call your reside school.
Which is just basically your kind of what we would consider your neighborhood school.
And they look at diversity, which is whether you come from a Category 1, 2, or 3 area.
And then we look at choice, so whether you rated it as your first choice or your last choice.
At the end of this process, more than 90% of families who apply on time get their first or second choice school.
I was surprised how difficult it was for me since I'm an employee in the system.
This is a Louisville resident who's a parent and a teacher in the school system. She wanted to be anonymous for this story since she works for the district. I'll call her Kelly.
It's really a process for parents and that, you know, other parents were telling me, oh, it's, you know, come around December, haven't you toured schools? Were you a kindergartner yet? And I didn't realize I was supposed to be touring schools.
The clusters, too, can be confusing. There are neighborhoods across the city from each other that belong to the same cluster. Even houses on the same street can be in different clusters. When Kelly and her husband bought their house,
I thought we were in one, and our next door neighbor on one side is in a separate cluster from us, and someone down the street is in another cluster. So it was hard to tell, certainly by the map.
When it came down to it, Kelly decided not to send her daughter to one of the cluster schools at all. Instead, they went to a magnet program downtown, which is part of the public schools, but outside of the regular cluster system. I should add, all this is just for elementary school. The middle school and high school systems are slightly different. So is all this complication worth it? Is the system working? Here's Dina Dossett again.
So that's a good question. Is the system working? And I would say, overall, yes, it's working.
There are a couple ways to judge this. First, the schools aren't as racially integrated as they were when busing was based just on race, but 90% of them do fall within the district's ideal diversity makeup. That's not too bad. And according to a survey Erica Frankenberg conducted a few years ago, more than 90% of parents in the district were happy with the program. That's not too bad either. But there might be a measure of success beyond the schools, and it has to do with the city itself.
It's unusual to have such a long-standing commitment to a broad-based school desegregation plan.
Genevieve Siegel-Hawley is a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. She says that school integration radiates out into the rest of the community.
If you're exposed to school integration, especially early in life, then you're more likely to seek it out later in life. in diverse colleges, in diverse workplaces, in diverse neighborhoods.
She found that residential segregation is falling twice as fast in Louisville as it is in similar cities that haven't committed to busing across city and suburban lines. Busing, she says, can create a kind of positive feedback loop for integration.
If you're a graduate of an integrated school and you seek out a diverse neighborhood later in life, then that in turn can flow into an intergenerational cycle of integration.
If you live in an integrated neighborhood, you send your kid to a more integrated school, which makes them more likely to live in an integrated neighborhood when they grow up and send their kids to more integrated schools. You get the idea.
I think it shows the self-perpetuating nature of integration, that if you start it and you keep going, people become committed to it over time.
That's Erica Frankenberg again.
You know, people don't like to be compared to a four-year-old. I have a four-year-old, and you know, he's scared of things before he tries it, but then, you know, he sees it's not that bad. I think experience with things across lines of difference can lead for anxiety, but when implemented, folks realize that it's not that bad.
For Louisville, the next new thing is just around the corner. Another possible challenge to the integration program in the shape of school choice. The Kentucky legislature recently approved charter schools in the state, and local charters could be up and running as early as next year. For With Good Reason, I'm Allison Quantz.
Often, school policy debates focus on urban and suburban schools. Rural schools get left out of the conversation. But nearly 10 million Americans attend rural schools, about a fifth of our student population. In many remote communities, schools are important beyond education. School buses pour money into local economies when they fill up at the gas station. After-school programs provide childcare for working parents. And the schools are often the biggest employer in the area. Mara Teakin is a professor at Bates College and the author of Why Rural Schools Matter. She says experts need to think about rural schools when they design education policy.
You know, No Child Left Behind is a really good example. In its first iteration, it had a highly qualified teaching provision. What that provision said was that in order to be able to be a licensed practicing teacher, you had to be highly qualified. And the way that the government defined highly qualified was having majored in your subject area. And that seems, you know, pretty common sense. You know, who would argue with that? But if you look at some rural schools, some very small rural schools, you might have a teacher that is teaching a biology class, a math class, and a chemistry class. And so for that teacher to have majored in all of those areas might be impossible. And he or she might have been a phenomenal teacher, been teaching quite successfully in the school district for 30 years. Right. And all of a sudden this policy gets introduced and rural schools are scrambling, trying to figure out, okay, how do we react to this? And how do we show that, again, probably well-intentioned, but it just doesn't work for our particular context and our particular needs.
You started your career as a teacher in a rural school district in Van Leer, Tennessee, population 398, and this was just as No Child Left Behind was taking effect. You've said that the sort of focus on testing brought to the fore your understanding of just how different the experience of these students was compared to maybe schools in more urban districts.
Yeah. You know, I was teaching third grade, and there was one of those math story problems. It involved something about an escalator. You know, people going from one floor to the next on an escalator, and it was basically a subtraction problem, and something that my students I knew would be able to do, except that they all got tripped up by the word escalator. They had no idea what an escalator was, no idea what that concept was. And so most of my students missed it. The test writers assume a particular context when they're writing these tests.
Many people have never experienced a rural school. Help us understand what they're like and what it was like for you in Van Leer, Tennessee.
I think the thing that stood out to me the most is the sense of closeness. Teachers know students, students know one another, principals know students, and not just the student, but they know families. They probably have taught the rest of the family. And this leads to a kind of like familiarity and a sense of closeness that to me was different than I had seen in more suburban and more urban settings. Another thing that can be striking is resources. Because our funding system in the U.S. relies on property taxes to fund schools, oftentimes then that means that the resources of the school are completely dependent upon the property values of the area. So if you've got a poor community, you often have a poor school. The first year I taught, we basically ran out of paper, copy paper, by the end of the year. And so each teacher had their two reams of paper that you were rationed out and you had to make do with. Those kinds of things, I think, are also often striking in rural areas where you see that just the material resources aren't there as they might be in other schools.
What sort of educational experience are children at most rural schools having?
It depends a lot on the class background of the rural area.
Right.
What we know generally is that, for example, NAEP scores, and NAEP is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It is a test that the federal government issues, and it's been given to students for decades, so we can see how they do over time. And so NAEP scores in rural schools are actually often higher than they are for urban children, and then lower in comparison to suburban kids. But then we see on other kinds of outcomes, we see rural students are often lagging behind their urban counterparts. So, for example, college enrollment and college attainment, rural levels are lower than for urban students.
You know, just about 20 miles from where I live is a small elementary school, and the school board just voted to close it over the pleadings of parents and community members who adored it, who grew up with it, and who, as you have said, counted on it as a rock in their lives, whether raising their young children there or their own memories of their experiences. Is that a familiar story for you?
It is. Consolidation is one of the most contentious issues in rural politics. The motivations for consolidation or closure are often complicated and really, really varied. And so I don't think consolidation is necessarily good or bad. I've got to say where I worry about it the most is the times when it's forced upon a district by the state. And also, if you look more broadly, research is beginning to suggest that school closure disproportionately happens to poor communities and rural communities of color. On the other hand, I have seen white communities resist consolidation primarily because they don't want their students to attend school with a more racially mixed population. So the motivations behind, you know, both pro-consolidation and anti-consolidation, I don't think there's necessarily good guys and bad guys here. I think it can be nuanced, it can be mixed. I worry that we're at a bit of an inflection point here. Within the past decade, about 35 states have either considered or adopted legislation around school closure and school consolidation. And we've seen vast decreases in the number of rural schools. And these rural schools are absolutely crucial for the education they provide within their buildings, but then also for this vital role they play for the sustainability of rural communities.
We think of rural schools as mostly white, but you argue that race is as much a part of education in rural America as it is in urban and suburban America. Why is that?
So 20% of people living in rural places are not white, and that 20% often gets overlooked, I think, in conversations about rural communities. And a lot of the same kinds of racial inequities that we see in urban places also exist in rural places. So segregation or people of color having less access to higher paying jobs or job security. Substandard housing can be a real issue for communities of color. And in general, rural poverty rates are higher than urban poverty rates. And those poverty rates can be even highest for rural communities of color. So race matters in all kinds of important ways for opportunity in rural places.
There's now a growing movement toward school choice and charter schools or vouchers for private schools. How do choice policies play out in rural schools?
So, I mean, choice only works if you've got choices, right? And, you know, a lot of rural communities, they just don't have the numbers of students to be able to have the variety of options that are kind of assumed with a lot of these choice policies. And so, you know, choice is a great story, but if you just don't have the choices, it doesn't amount to much for you. So that's kind of one way in which a lot of these choice policies could be very problematic for rural communities. But then also, what could end up happening is if choice becomes the reform, sort of the way to think about how to do schooling better, the one choice option that often exists for rural communities are virtual charter schools. And the research on virtual charter schools really suggests that these schools, there's probably a few exceptions, but for the most part, the education that these virtual charter schools offer is really substandard.
What's a virtual charter school?
So kids take online classes, basically, and they vary in structure, but, you know, they might never go to a brick and mortar school and just take classes online. But the research that's really emerging on these virtual charter schools show that the outcomes are really, really low in many of them. And so, I mean, this isn't much of a choice.
What do rural schools need most? What would have the biggest impact?
At its root, the way we fund our schools is inequitable. We rely so heavily on property taxes that property poor areas cannot provide the same kinds of resources that property rich areas can. Poverty rates are higher in rural areas than urban areas. And there's some pockets of rural poverty. It's persistent poverty. It's extreme poverty. And for these rural communities to provide even an adequate education, let alone an excellent one, becomes nearly impossible. And so I think the first fix I would make is, you know, we can't try to create equity on a foundation or on a structure that is, you know, at its core inequitable.
So before I let you go, do you love rural schools?
I love schools. I miss teaching. I miss teaching in a rural place. I miss walking into a school building where everyone knows you. You know everybody. I miss that kind of familiarity. I miss being in a rural place with young children and the kind of wonder. You know, I mean, one of the big advantages about teaching in a rural school is that you've got the entire outdoors right there. And being able to explore that with kids is just, it's amazing. You know, I remember picking blackberries with my students. In Van Leer, we had one of our students lived like right across the street from the school, and his ducks would follow him to school every day. And they would kind of flock underneath one of the cars in the parking lot. And I miss that intimacy that can really come with teaching in a rural place.
And yet, imagine doing it where you didn't have to ration your reams of paper.
Right, exactly. Imagine being able to like really make use of those amazing strengths and resources that can come with that place. Imagine being able to do that with microscopes and with paper and with staples and all of those kinds of things. There's so many resources. I don't make sure that doesn't get overlooked in this conversation. There's so many resources in rural areas. There are a lot that rural schools can teach schools in other places about how to educate and how to educate well. And relying on close relationships between community and school, inviting parents in, making use of what parents know, making use of that kind of knowledge within the classroom, blurring the boundaries a bit between school and community.
Well, Mara Teekin, thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mara Teekin is a professor of education at Bates College. Her book is Why Rural Schools Matter. This program is funded in part by a grant from the National Science Foundation. and from Dr. Oliver Hill at Virginia State University. Dr. Hill is undertaking a new research project, trying to address many of the problems we've studied in this show. His study will take a holistic look at why there aren't more minorities in STEM and what our education system can do to fix that. He's examining how math anxiety is different from other forms of student stress. He's trying out new models for retaining teachers in distressed districts, and he's building a curriculum to prepare students for the jump between high school and college math. Dr. Hill is now collecting preliminary data from Richmond, Petersburg, Philadelphia, and New Orleans. We'll be hearing more from him when he publishes the results of his new study. If you're interested in participating in a study or just want to know more, get in touch with us at With Good Reason. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by the law firm of McGuire Woods and by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced in Charlottesville by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, Elliot Majerzik, Allison Quantz, Lilia Fukin, and John Last are our associate producers. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. Our intern is Victoria Joyner. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Omni646, and I am inviting you to listen to the best in R&B and hip-hop, some video game music, a little bit of light rock, I mean, pretty much whatever I want to listen to. And I figure if I want to listen to it, you probably want to listen to it. Now, we're on every Saturday, except for the first Saturday. That's not including me. I got to figure, right? We're on every Saturday, except for the first Saturday, from 10 to midnight, on the Invitation Make Waves, 8903. VHFR.FM.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
That's where my baby stays.